may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again on truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org. It's season 2 of Torah Pearls. I'm Jono, and joining me in the virtual Truth to You studio all the way from Ireland is Jason of spiritualbabies.net. I'm going to have to make that sentence a little bit shorter because every time I read it, I always run out of air. It's got too many words. I need a pause there or something.
At least you don't have to do the big Mr. Spiritual Babies thing anymore, because that used to just wreck your throat.
No, yeah, that's right.
I don't want to spoil the kind of magic of broadcasting, but it's just past midnight on February.
You're in the wee hours of the morning.
And it's Friday, it's Friday the 13th.
Oh, really?
Yeah, seriously.
What does it mean?
That means that it's the day after the 12th.
Ah! It does mean that. I never put that together. That's why you're on the program. Now, what? Just while I've got you, what are the wee hours of the morning?
You know when you're in bed and you wake up and then you really need the toilet?
Is that really the wee hours of the morning? Is that what
it is?
Means? Are you serious?
No. We just mean small. So it's the early hours. Yeah.
You're in the small hours of the morning there in Ireland. There you go. And where it's not the small hours of the morning, with a special guest joining us for the first time, our friend Ken Lane in Tulsa. I hope I pronounced that right. Oklahoma. Ken Lane, otherwise known as Yefet Ben Ezra of OkieHebrew.com. OkieHebrew.com. That's O-K-I-E, Hebrew.com. G'day, my friend.
Hey, what's going on?
Well, I'll tell you what, it's the wee hours of the morning in Ireland.
I just got off
What
work.
Is it there in Tulsa, Oklahoma?
It's like 6:15 at night.
How's your cat?
Good. He just jumped up on the table as you said that. He must can hear notice. Straight through the headphones.
Yep. It's lovely to have you on the program. Oh, can you just let everybody know? Come on, Okie Hebrew, just fill everybody in.
I started it as a blog, and it was called Hebrew in an Okie accent, because I used to be a part of different congregations in Oklahoma, and it always cracked me up whenever they would do Hebrew liturgy with the Oklahoma accent, and it'd be like, Rukatad Onai Lahenu Meleka Olam, and I just thought that was awesome. So it was Hebrew in an Okie accent, and the web address was OkieHebrew.com, so I just shortened the whole website to it. But yeah, it's just kind of a Midwest perspective on Torah, Judaism, and everything and the like. So,
well, I've been enjoying some of your podcasts of late, and I would encourage people to go and have a look. So it's OkieHebrew.com, and there's some great, nice little short podcasts there, very concise information that I've appreciated from you lately, my friend. I'm looking forward to listening to a few more of those, and thank you for coming on to Torah Pearls with such short notice. People, I gave him 15 minutes.
Yeah,
he said, "All right,
the bat phone.
I'll just leave work."
I felt like Dick Tracy, like when they call him on the watch, and he's calling Dick. Can you get on a podcast right now? I'm like, okay,
right now.
Yeah, I can. That's cool.
And he did. So thank you so much, my friend. Of course, Tobias Singer, missing in action. Actually, you know what? I think he's in – where is he, Jason? Is he in Houston, Texas somewhere?
Yeah, somewhere in Dallas.
All right.
That's what he's doing. But it probably involves an audience and some Bible study.
Yeah, so he got stuck in some sort of live Bible study situation, which is a wonderful thing to be stuck in. And I'll probably be joining him next week. We'll see how it goes. But thank you, Ken, for coming on. Now, comments. Chad wrote in. G'day, Chad. Said, really awesome and insightful Torah Pearls. I am really blessed. I'm really blessed by the work that y'all – hey, I got a y'all. There Woo-hoo! You go, that y'all do. There you go, Ken. I hope that someday the opportunity arrives that I will be able to meet at least one of you guys. We can, Chad. You can come on the tour if you like. We won't stop you, and there's still some seats available. Of course, Jason and I, Tovia and Ross Nichols are going on tour in Israel in the first couple of weeks of November. You can get the details of that on the website, truth2u.org. You'll see Israel Tour 2015. Click on that. It'll give you all the details that you need to meet us in the land. And what a better place to – there is no better place to get together than the land. And he says, keep being a blessing to people. We certainly hope that we will be. Chatting. Thanks for your comment. This week, we are in Mishpatim, Exodus chapter 21, verse 1 to Exodus chapter 24, verse 18. Fellas, you ready?
Let's go.
Sure.
Now, these are the judgments which you shall set before them. If you buy a Hebrew servant, straight off the bat, this is, I just got to say, this is not, a lot of this, Ken, I guess, is not really very politically correct.
No,
this chapter.
Well, not really, but the Hebrew is a little bit different in that. I've heard differing interpretations on what the word slave actually implies. The word for slave that's used throughout the Tanakh is Eved, that's spelled Ayin Vav Dalet. And it's used for servant and slave kind of interchangeably. You kind of have to check out the context and see what it is. But throughout this Parsha, one of my favorite Parshas, just because it's so straightforward and just like a book of, it's just like a list of rules, which I think is great. It really kind of, it puts it in context and really smashes the whole idea of you know, I have a whole lot of people that when I talk to them and they say, oh, well, you keep the Old Testament or whatever. And they go, oh, well, you agree with slavery, don't you? And I'm like, depends on what you mean by that, but let's look at the context here.
This is exactly what we're going to do, because it does carry its own. I mean, we look at, you know, some translations will say slave, some will say, as it says here, servant. And we impose upon that ideas from our own culture, which doesn't necessarily accurately concur with what is in the text as far as the context is concerned, as you pointed out. Jason.
And it's worth remembering that when we finished the last Torah portion, we did the Ten Commandments, which was kind of, you know, the big to-do list. Then we went on to what how altars should be built. And then when this Torah portion starts, although we read there, now these are the ordinances, or these are the rules, or these are the laws, it actually says, and these are. So this is a continuation of last week's Torah portion. And how does it start? Does it start with, and you who are the heads of the clans, or you who are the landowners, or you who are the farmers, or you who are the priests? It starts with the lowest form. So if when it starts to talk about what civil liberties are and who you should protect first, it starts with the servant and the bondsman. And I think that in itself is a great... If the Torah was really about slavery and the kind of the shackles of the 1800s type slavery, then why place there the slaves... Personal.
They'd be lucky to get a mention at all.
Yeah, they would. So why? I mean, why make aware? I mean, we're going to read in this how if a slave is bruised, he gets compensation. If he loses a tooth, he gets his freedom. I mean, this isn't the same type of slavery that we think of with you know, the slavery of 1718 and 1900s. This is a different indenture, a different type of servant, a different type of bondsman.
Fair enough. So Ken, can you take us through it? What kind of servants are we talking about here? How does it work?
Well, it's really interesting because the kind of historical context of this, especially when you kind of compare it to pre-13th Amendment antebellum South type of slavery, is really interesting because actually this status presents an opportunity to the people to pay off debts, to have somewhere to live, you know, three hots and a cot type of thing. Because there are certain obligations that the quote-unquote slave master has to his, in my English translation, it says the Hebrew serf. So that's kind of interesting. But it was an opportunity for people who were either prisoners of war or, you know, captives of war, foreigners who came in from other towns, or people who had a debt to repay. You know, it wasn't in other cultures like taken out of their flesh. They had an opportunity to live and work and be treated with respect as they do that. And they had certain rules. They kind of went into it too. So
when you say taken out of their flesh, I mean, in other cultures, are you serious?
Well, yeah. If in other cultures, if you had a debt to pay with somebody, they might not always go, oh, well, he owes me money. If you don't have any money, where are they going to take it from? They're going to you might get beaten or something like that as payment, and that is strictly against Torah. So I think that it kind of shows the how the Israelites were different from the other nations around them, that they had these certain kind of rules set up.
So if someone has fallen on hard times, this is a form of Torah welfare, can I say that?
Kind of, like when, you know, you don't have anything else to sell, you sell yourself. You could sell yourself into slavery, you know, and that's kind of one way to go about it. Now it's kind of interesting. Nowadays, well, they had like debtor's prisons and stuff in other cultures and stuff, but this is, it's not really a debtor's prison, it's kind of more of a work program.
which maintains the individual's dignity, right? But I mean, you don't just get money for nothing. You maintain your dignity by selling yourself into a form of labor, and it's a way of putting yourself back on your feet. Is that fair to say?
I'd say so. Okay. Yeah, pretty.
All right. So this is, it goes on. It says he shall serve for 6 years, and in the seventh he shall go out free and pay nothing. And if he comes in by himself, he should go out by himself. And if he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master has given him a wife, and she has borne him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out by himself. If he gives him a wife, and she bears him children, the wife and the children seem to belong to the master. But after 6 years, on the seventh year, he will go out by himself. But if the servant plainly says, I love my master and my wife and my children, I will not go out free. Well, here's the remedy. Then his master shall bring him to the judges. He shall bring him to the door or to the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an oar. And he shall serve him forever. So I guess
the guy in servitude wouldn't have had the opportunity to find himself a wife. That would definitely involve some sort of dowry, or he would have been given another female bondsperson as a wife. And that cost would have been incurred by the owner, by the person that was buying them for that period of time. So I can see how he may be able to leave. But the wife, even though married and now having children, still technically comes under the remit and ownership of the owner. So that's probably now at the end of the 7 years, I'm sure that she, everything being equal, would be allowed to leave. I mean, that's not this. You have to remember that these servants aren't lifetime. They're not kind of owned for their whole lifetime, as we're going to get into. The thing with it all is kind of interesting, and some people might find that in their translations it will say that then his master shall bring him unto God. It is the Hebrew there. It's going to be divided in English between God and judges, and I think judges is probably a fairer translation. But he takes them to the door. Traditionally, it's understood that he takes them to the door, so the judges can watch the owner pierce the guy's ear with the awl, and that way he can't forcibly. I mean, imagine if the guy just turned up with a hole in his ear, you could pin him down. Three people hold him down. I'll bang him in the head with this, and then I own him forever. That's you need a witness. And so by taking him to the door of the building,
it's a witness to the public and a witness to the household.
Absolutely. The guy's standing there of his own free will. They could even maybe ask, are you sure you want to do this? And he can say yes. And then he's made that. We have to remember as well that we keep harping on about the servants and slaves. But in the story of Eliezer and Abraham, before Abraham had a child, Eliezer was in line to take on everything Abraham had. So, he was a servant. He was a slave. So that's a world away from what we imagine, the shackled and chained slaves. You know, when we think slavery, we have a very specific image of slavery. And it's not at all what we're reading in the Torah. It's a world apart.
Ken?
Well, because even further, if you go into the Torah, if you look at the essence of the pre-13th Amendment antebellum slavery period where people are kidnapped and put into forced servitude for the rest of their lives, if for someone were to do that in the time of the giving of the Torah and people who would uphold this, they would be killed. Kidnapping someone is a capital offense. And so that really completely throws off the whole kind of trying to compare one type of slavery or servitude with this other one that is more of a holy one. And there are several other laws that kind of make that very, very crystal clear. We already touched on it. The one being that the person has the option of staying a slave forever, which obviously, like, usually if you read that out of context, you'd be like, what, are they out of their minds? Do they want to remain slaves the rest of their lives? But that means they're well treated.
Yeah.
That there's some kind of incentive to keep doing that. The other rule of slavery that shows how well they were treated is that if you come across a runaway slave, and this isn't actually in this portion, but it is kind of related to it. It's actually in Deuteronomy. But if you come across a runaway slave or runaway Avid, then you're actually supposed to put them up wherever they want. They stay in someone's house. You're supposed to kind of give them what they want. It says you should not give him up to his master. An Eved who has escaped from his master, he shall dwell with you in your midst. In that place he shall choose within one of your towns, whatever suits him, you shall not wrong him. So that really kind of speaks to, if somebody's kidnapped or if somebody runs away, that clearly shows that they're being mistreated. And you're supposed to kind of put them, you're supposed to give them what they want, give them a nice place to stay in the meantime,
right,
because they've been through a lot.
So it goes on, it says, and if a man sells his daughter to be a female slave, she shall not go out as the male slaves do. If she does not please her master who has betrothed her to himself, then he shall let her be redeemed.
So a guy takes on a female slave for himself as a second or third wife, would never have been a first wife. This would have been like an extra conjugal partner. But the children of that relationship have total equal right. So if this guy had a regular wife and 12 children, then he takes on a slave and has another three. Those three are entitled to the same rights as his first wife. And if he decides he's not interested in that person anymore, her family gets a chance to take her back. Also, what's kind of interesting is if he doesn't treat her right, she has the right just to leave without their family paying that money. So I think it even says, and if he takes another wife, her food, her raiment, and her conjugal rights, he shall not diminish. So if he doesn't feed her, clothe her, and look after her as a husband should look after his wife, I think that's a polite way of saying that. If he doesn't do these things to her, then she should go out for nothing without money. So he doesn't have to get his money because he's paid for her. I think that's what it's trying to say. But she can leave without any restitution for his loss.
Is that the way you see it, Ken? Is that?
Yep. But it also shows that she's well treated, and that this is a necessity even for somebody that's seemingly as low as a servant.
It continues on in verse 12. He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. However, if he did not lie in wait, but God delivered him into his hand, then I will appoint for you a place where he may flee. Now we're talking about the city of refuge, right? This is what we're talking about here, but which we read in a little bit more detail later on in the Torah. But if a man acts with premeditation against his neighbor to kill him by treachery, you shall take him from my altar that he may die. And he who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. He who kidnaps a man will and sells him, if he is found in his hand, he shall surely be put to death. Jason?
Just a skippy part on verse 14, it says, take from my altar, and that's most commonly understood as being, even if, we know that there was a period in the Middle Ages where if people committed a crime, they'd run to their church and seek sanctuary. And people tried to do that with the altar, so that if they absolutely, I'm going to smash that guy in the face, and then they go and smash the guy in the face and he dies. That's what they say here as presumptuously came upon his neighbor. And then he might say, oh, no, what have I done? And he runs to the altar to try and get some sort of forgiveness. But the text says that that's no good. You take that guy away from the altar, he's going to die. So I find that kind of interesting that there is this idea of sanctuary even here. But there are some things that go above. Now, God's very merciful, but there are some things that even he's not going to look over. And so I find verse 14 kind of an interesting one there.
16, though, he who kidnaps a man and sells him. You were telling me something about this.
Right, so there is an understanding that to kidnap a person and take them away from his people is looked upon in the same manner as murder. So when we look in the commandment that you shouldn't murder, that can be paralleled with kidnapping. Because if you take someone away from their people, Israel, then you are, first of all, you're taking away their freedom, and then you're taking away their spiritual link. And that is kind of it's a death.
Forcibly cut off, right?
They've been forcibly cut off from their people. And you'll often read that they should, if so-and-so does such and such a thing, they'll be cut off from their people. And that's a spiritual death. And they're looked upon as the same thing. As Ken said a moment ago, kidnapping is a really serious thing. And it's looked at with the same kind of horror and punished in the same way as murderers. Mm.
Verse 17, he who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. Ken, curses his mother or his father, like what may their house be full of cockroaches? What does it mean to curse a mother and father?
Oh, well, this has a whole lot of different interpretations to it, really depending on whoever you ask. And it's really interesting in my English translation. It says, should be put to death. Yes, death. Like, read it. Like someone read it and said, "Death, really?"
Really?
And they kept reading. Yes, death. I think this was probably, it didn't really have, and I can't really speak to this historically, but this is just kind of the way it feels whenever I read it, that this is, being that they lived in such a tight community, they, you know, the Torah was the law of the land. We don't really even, we can't even start to understand how this is, because there is really nowhere in the world where the Torah is the law of the land. Not even in the state of Israel. It still is a secular country with its own laws that are, you know, somewhat based on the Torah, but not really. So when the Torah is the law of the land, and it says that anyone who curses, or in my translation, it says anyone, he that insults his father or mother shall be put to death. Yes, death.
So insults. So when you talk about that, and you maybe when you compare that to the commandment to honor your mother and father, then I suppose that this is the direct opposite.
Right. And I would say that because this had such a severe penalty to it, you don't actually read a whole lot about people who are put to death because they insult their mother and father. Mm. I would think that it was more of a guideline for, hey, look how severe this is, and it kind of denotes that you need to have that much respect for your parents in a Torah-centered community, which I'm kind of jealous of.
Yeah, and I suppose that's the other thing, too. I mean, Jason, we don't all live in Torah-centered. I mean, who lives in a Torah-centered community? I mean, if we all had Torah-centered parents, I would imagine this would be a much easier commandment to keep. But as it is for some of us, it's not necessarily the easiest. Maybe we should leave that there and keep going.
Well, something else to add on that, too. One of the things that I've heard from what is said before you, say you're converting to Judaism or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I actually kind of experienced, I'm not going to name any names, but there was someone involved in conversion when they took this very harshly. They took it the wrong way whenever someone said, okay, now that you're Jewish, they said it was kind of poetically the way the people converting them said that your father's no longer your father, your mother's no longer your mother, now Israel is your family. And they didn't mean that literally this biological person is no longer whoever it is, because if they're not Jewish, they're just talking about spiritually. Mm-hmm. And this person had a big problem with this. And I mean, and it kind of put the brakes on things for a little while until they stopped and explained it. They go, no, you should still have a good relationship with your parents, even if they believe differently than you, because that is a part of the Torah. But you need to understand that, I mean, what would happen if someone did come into a life of Torah and their parents were completely non-Torah, but then there's the commandment that you should honor your father and mother, and they want you to come over, they want you to drive over on Saturday for ham.
Right. That's a great example. Yeah, that's right. And because Judaism is a family, it's not a creed like Christianity, right?
Right.
And you are being adopted into that family.
It's your
new, into that covenant.
Yeah. It's your new family. Welcome home.
There it is. Welcome home. There it is. Okay. So if men contend with each other and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist and he does not die but is confined to his bed, if he rises again, walks outside with his staff, then he who struck him shall be acquitted. He shall only pay for the loss of his time and shall provide for him to be thoroughly healed, is what I've got here. So this is kind of like compensation. This is exactly what that is, I suppose. And if a man beats his male or female servant with a rod so that he dies under his hand, he shall surely be punished. Notwithstanding, if he remains alive a day or two, then he shall not be punished. Ken, what do you make of it? And this is what I've got in the New King James, for he is his property.
Right. Well, first off, on the other part about it is worth noting, it's very interesting that, again, a slave should be avenged if they're killed. So mm-hmm. What does that mean? If you were to put that in the context of what the slavery that everyone else assumes is slavery, if a slave master were to hit their slave and their slave died, how many times would you hear of that slave master being strung up?
Yeah, well, that's
never.
A good point. Yeah.
But for them to be avenged, if, you know, they're alive after that beating because they're their own money. One of the commentaries that I have says that they don't have the exact same human rights as a free man.
That's how, just in the plain reading, that would be fair to come to that conclusion, surely.
Yeah. And especially if it was an incident that happened with someone else involved. And you read later on in the portion about how people are, you know, paid for if somebody else were to, just like anything else, injure their property to that nature. So
right.
Okay. I mean, it's kind of it's hard to be really politically correct with that verse, but that's just kind of the way it was.
I don't think there is a politically correct comeback to that verse, but there you go. That's what it says, and there's something for people to think about. If men fight and hurt a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet no harm follows, he shall surely be punished accordingly as the woman's husband imposes on him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. But if any harm follows, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. Jason, what do you reckon?
It's we often, especially the tradition that we come from the Christian tradition, we're often told an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth is a real life thing. You know, if you take your eye, you pluck out your own eye. And but we know that this actually is talking more about monetary cost. It's like a shopping list of things. And compensation. If you lose an eye, then how much was the eye worth to you? I mean, if you do something that didn't involve a depth of perception, you might kind of be all right without your eyes. But if you was doing something that you absolutely needed your eye for, then the cost would be more. It's kind of interesting that at the end of verse 19 it says, "And shall cause him to be thoroughly healed." I'd like to think that it's not just about physical healing, but about spiritual and mental healing too. I mean, if you were forced to go into a burning fire, a burning barn to get something expensive, that could really psychologically mess you up. And I'd like to think that then you wouldn't be placed in that same situation, because you needed to be thoroughly healed. But what I wanted to get to was a wound for a wound and a stripe for a stripe. Now, a wound is an open cut that will bleed, and a stripe is a bruise.
Mm-hmm.
So, without making any huge jumps, by his stripes we should be healed means by his bruises, not by his open wounds. So I'm going to say.
Okay, so you're quoting from Isaiah, right?
I am, and I thought that was a kind of interesting. We often, you know, we're kind of inundated with these really horrific pictures of this guy being flailed, and those flails are supposed to be stripes, but they're not, because then there would be wounds. If it says by his wounds, it'd be one thing, but we're given, the Christians will even often up the word stripe.
You know what, if my memory serves me correctly, I think it can also be rendered, that verse in Isaiah, by his infliction we are restored. But, you know, we're going to be getting to that with Rabbi Michael Skobeck in the next 365 Messianic Prophecies recording. We're going to be doing Isaiah chapter 53.
Wow.
Boy, it's going to be really good. Any thoughts on that, Ken?
Yeah. In some translations I've read, along with some commentaries on this verse, even though there is monetary compensation for these things, it was still put, as all of these other things, were put before a judge to kind of weigh out the fairness of what was going on. Because in some systems, what would happen if there was a really, really rich man who just thought he could go around causing all kinds of injustice and just paying it off?
Sure. Yeah.
So that in some instances, there were other types of penalties that were a little more, shall we say, peshat, when it comes to how they were carried out. So I would say, yeah, sometimes they were monetary, but we can't forget, some people assume that a lot of these judgments were carried out by people, you know, meeting in the town square and going, the Torah says this, let's just do it. No, there were judges, there was a court system that would determine these things to make sure that the punishment fit the crime.
I want to, thanks for bringing that up. I want to highlight life for life, because we're talking about a baby in its mother's womb. And when it comes to issues like abortion, I think this is a very valid and relevant couple of verses to take into consideration. The baby in its mother's womb is referred to as a life, and if that life is taken, then life for life. Verse 26, if a man strikes the eye of his male or female servant and destroys it, he shall let him go free for the sake of his eye. And if he knocks out a tooth of his male or female servant, he shall let him go free for the sake of his tooth. Animals, if an ox gores a man or a woman to death, then the ox shall surely be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten. It'd be pretty tender though, wouldn't it? No, I shouldn't say that. Okay. Wouldn't it? You're supposed to tenderize it after you kill it? No. Okay, moving on. The ox shall be stoned. But the owner of the ox See, this is what happens when Toby's not here.
The ox should be tenderized to death.
I feel like the parents have gone out and left the kids at home by themselves.
Hide the matches.
You know, there's a twisted part of my brain wondering whether that would make the meat actually any better. You know, the cruelty button's ticked off. That's not working anymore. And I'm thinking, what if that would make really, really great steak?
You shed it, and then you stone it.
you can't, because it's not because it still contains the blood.
Right.
In any case.
Yeah.
And in fact,
and then you run into all kind of issues with the bruising of the blood and trying to drain it. Maybe
that's
animal rights people start hanging around your front door. And
the longer I think about it, there's a long list of Torah that would stand in the way of eating this animal. But, you know, I'll tell you what, it's fair enough that it should be put down. It says if the ox tended to thrust with its horns in times past, and it has been made known to the owner, and he has not kept it confined so that it killed a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned and its owner shall be put to death. Well, how about that? I mean, because the owner is responsible as well. The owner knew.
Yep.
It's fair enough.
That would basically be ancient Israel, kind of a form of manslaughter, but not...
yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, and... Even though for manslaughter in the States or whatever, you know, or wherever, you're not killed for it, but
no, but Ken, if you've got you've got your car and you know that the brakes aren't working that well and you take the risk anyway and you take your car out and there's a situation where you have to jam the brakes on real quick and it's not quick enough and you kill someone.
Yeah.
Well, is that not a form of manslaughter?
Well, just like I read the other day about the captain of that one cruise liner who, I can't remember exactly why he ran it aground. He was tried and they put him in jail for like 16 or 17 years.
Yeah.
So that was, that could have been fallen under the, that's a really big ox.
That's a big ox and a lot of people died as a result. Yep. And so it says, so verse 30, if there is imposed on him a sum of money, then he shall pay to redeem his life whatever is imposed on him, whether it has gored a son or gored a daughter, according to his judgment it shall be done to him. If the ox gores a male or female servant, he shall give to their master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. Jason, what do you make of it?
Well, this is kind of a little interesting nugget, because we know from Leviticus 27, I want to say it's 27, that a Hebrew slave is worth 50 shekels. But here we see 30. And so the understanding of this is that this isn't a Hebrew bondsman and bondswoman. It's a heathen or a pagan bondsperson. And that's why they're valued less. And I thought that was worth highlighting. You will see all the way through that the cost of virginity, if you take a bride, is 50 shekels. And there's 50 shekels, 50 shekels, 50 shekels, but here 30. And the understanding there is that this isn't a... And I wonder whether that's because... A person that would look after an animal, because the chances are that this would be someone that was in proximity to the animal, would normally have been a Hebrew. Maybe they were kind of outsourcing and they gave the kind of crappier jobs or the more dangerous jobs to a certain type of slave.
Interesting. All right. We're thinking about it. And if a man opens a pit, or he digs a pit and does not cover it up, and an ox or a donkey falls into it, the owner of the pit shall make it good. He shall give money to their owner, but the dead animal shall be his.
I just want to jump in here real quick.
Go on.
Now, where is the verse that says, and if a man falls into the pit?
Where is that?
There it doesn't exist, because if there's a big hole in the ground and you fall in, it's your own fault. That's literally it. It's literally why it doesn't say that. If you've covered the ground, if someone's on the roof of your house and it's dangerous and that's why you have to put the fence around it, you're responsible for that. But if you've clearly got a big hole in your land and a human walks into it, they figure it's your problem.
Well, now, you know, I did think about this because there are cases sometimes when we have what we call dams or, you know, little water holes, lakes, little tiny ponds, there you go. We call them dams for the livestock out in the out on the land. And when there's a drought and the water is quite low, some of those holes can get really quite deep and very muddy at the bottom. And because animals, you know, they get thirsty, they take the risk, they will purposefully get down into that hole. to get to the water, but because it's muddy, they can't get out again. And if no one is checking the water holes, then it's not unusual to find an animal that has passed away in one of those holes.
Well, I think in this instance, they're specifically talking about a pet in regards to waterhole, like you were saying, but they should almost always have been covered. It reduces the amount of theft. And moreover, if supposing that's the only source of water that you have on your land, and then an animal falls into it and dies, you can't drink from that anymore.
You don't want that water, no.
Right. So I think there was probably more going on than just that animal being an issue. But it's definitely regarding a water pit, the same kind of thing that Joseph would have got thrown into. But it's literally a storage thing, and I think it's probably the same as when Ken was mentioning that most of these were, if you do this, you'll get killed, as a way to deter people. I think this was probably deterrent to make them remember to put the stones back over their water.
Yeah, this whole verse would make the modern lawyers very unhappy, because, you know, nowadays we have warning labels on absolutely everything, which this is by law, but this is kind of just well, as Jason mentioned, it doesn't say for a person that if a person falls into it, that's just kind of telling Israel, hey, you need to kind of be smart, be responsible. And
common sense, people.
Yeah.
That coffee that you bought, it's hot. Common sense.
It's really hot.
It's really hot. If a man steals, chapter 22, if a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he shall restore 5 oxen for an ox, 4 sheep for a sheep.
Right.
And so now, just jumping back to what you were saying about the lawyers of the land today, this one doesn't fly so much, if I understand correctly, in the States. If the thief is found breaking in and he is struck so that he dies, there shall be no guilt for his bloodshed. What's the law of the land there at the moment? Isn't in the States, I mean, if someone breaks into your house, aren't you meant to, you know, make them a milkshake and give them a sandwich and ask them if there's anything else that they need and load them up and send them on their way?
Oh, man, that depends on what state you're in.
Oh,
certain states.
What is it in Oklahoma?
Oklahoma's pretty much shoot first, ask questions later a little bit.
Oh,
we're kind of cowboys down here. But I wouldn't necessarily call it just a straight up stay on your ground law. But there are certain states in the United States that are a little way more accommodating for people to protect themselves with, say, firearms or whatever. But I did hear of a case once where a burglar, I think he was crawling through a skylight and fell into the kitchen on a knife and sued the family and won.
Wow. It blows my mind!
But that's just a commentary of how that legal system is so far removed from this legal system.
Man, doesn't it? I mean, if that happened, honestly, what I think should happen is that a statue should be made, put in the public square, of the thief with the knife in his butt and say, this is what happened to this guy.
This is butt knife, everybody.
Yeah. Butt knife man.
Butt knife man. Jason,
butt knife man.
What is the law of the land in Ireland if someone's breaking into your house?
Hey, you don't want to do that in Ireland.
Okay.
You know, if someone comes into this property and I smash him over the face with whatever's handy, chances are it'd be all right. Wouldn't be a problem.
Okay. All right. Not the case everywhere. It says, if the sun has risen on him, there shall be guilt for his bloodshed. He should make full restitution. If he has nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. If the theft is certainly found alive in his hand, whether it is an ox or a donkey or a sheep, he shall restore double. So
I think that kind of means if it's nighttime and you kill the guy, it's not your lookout, because you couldn't see him. If it's daytime, you should shoot him in the knee. That's the knee shot.
So that's the knee shot.
You've got a chance to take him down. And if the guy doesn't have anything on him, then he gets literally sold for theft. And if he has got something on him, then he has to pay back double the worth of the item.
All right.
Thanks.
Fair enough. Okay, makes sense. If a man causes a field or a vineyard to be grazed and lets loose animals and it feeds in another man's field, he should make restitution from the best of his own field and the best of his own vineyard. Fair enough. If fire breaks out and catches in thorns so that stacked grain, standing grain, or the field is consumed, then he who kindled the fire shall surely make restitution. Fair enough. If a man delivers to his neighbor money or articles to keep, and it is stolen out of the man's house, if the thief is found, he shall pay double. If the thief is not found, then the master of the house shall be brought to the judges to see whether he has put his hand to his neighbor's goods. Now,
I've got embezzle. And it's worth mentioning that in the last four we've covered, the first three are really about people that aren't paying attention. So the guy sets his animals free, knowing they're going to go into his neighbor's field. And then a guy sets a fire, knowing it's possible that that's going to... So they are responsible. It's not an accident. They haven't paid attention. And this one, someone's said, I'm going away for a couple of weeks. Will you look after this really important, valuable thing? And the guy says, yeah, sure, I'll look after it. And then comes home, where's my super invaluable, important thing? You know, my house was broken into. We'll see. The judges come around. There's no proof of a break-in. We can't find a robber. So then they go and check to see whether the guy has robbed it himself. Not good. But yeah, embezzling. And so this is really about people who are twisting the facts to for their own gain.
Now, you said judges. Incidentally, this is another, verse 9 is another example where the word judges, in the Hebrew canon, I believe it's Elohim. So Psalm 82 says, God stands in the congregation of the mighty. He judges among the gods, I've got here. And it's got a little star there, and it says the word is Elohim, mighty ones, that is, judges. It goes on to say in verse 6, I said, you are gods. And all of you are children of the Most High. Again, the word is Elohim. And again, a little asterisk there in my New King James Study Bible. And it says, mighty ones, that is, judges. Now, I know some translations do put judges in there. Here is such a case where I do believe the word is Elohim. And it is rendered as judges in verse 9. And it is?
Yep, absolutely.
Thank you for confirming that for me, my friend. Just something interesting to throw into the mix. If a man delivers his neighbor's donkey, an ox, a sheep, or any animal to keep, and it dies, is hurt, is driven away, no one seeing it, then an oath to the Lord shall be between them both. Ken, what does it mean? An oath to the Lord shall be between them both.
Well, I'm just, it brings in modern day what we'd consider to make sure they don't perjure. Because they're bringing in an oath to go and go, okay, we want to ask you what's going on here exactly. Mm-hmm. And usually making promises before Hashem, which I think it is the actual Tetragrammaton.
It's the Tetragrammaton. So they're invoking the name in a promise or a vow saying, I swear I did not do this thing.
Yeah.
Pretty serious stuff.
Yeah, the oath of Hashem is to be between the two of them, and this is... assumed to be to inquire if he didn't send out his hand against his neighbor's property.
If he fears God, he certainly would not make such an oath. He wouldn't invoke the name and swear falsely.
No, that's just, even though today in today's society, people say, I swear to God, that's a big no-no. Back then, that was kind of understood. And that was a quick way to get to the root of a problem, I assume.
Yeah, and that's fair enough. But if, in fact, it says if he stole it, he shall make restitution to the owner. If it's torn to pieces by a beast, then he shall bring evidence and he'll make good what was torn. If a man borrows anything from his neighbor and it becomes injured or dies, the owner of it not being with it, he shall surely make it good. If the owner was with it, then he shall not make it good. If it was hired, it came for its hire. 16. If a man entices a virgin who is not betrothed and lies with her, he shall surely pay the bride price for her to be his wife. If the father utterly refuses to give her to him, he shall pay, and this is what you were saying, Jason, he shall pay money according to the bride price of virgins. And am I right? You pointed out that was 50 shekels.
That's right, 50 silver shekels.
So you seduce a virgin or you sleep with a virgin, all you got to do is pay it off? Really, this doesn't have much to do with that, because the seduction is not, it would mean it would be consensual. Mm-hmm. And I think some people kind of overlook that.
Right.
That would be the case. I don't know. Some people see it plain on the head, and some people go, oh man, well, if this happens, that's all he has to do, and that's an outrage. And that would be an outrage if that were the case, but it's not.
Okay, good. Jason?
While we're there, we may as well go for it. So a guy says entices, I think it's supposed to be inducing her to be a consensual partner. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, imagine the situation. You've got a daughter and you're hoping that she's going to marry into a healthy, loving relationship. Mm-hmm. And then she gets kind of... she loses her virginity in whatever situation that is.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can't marry her off. So the whole point here is that this the dowry that's offered up, it used to go to the father, but later on it went to the daughter, so the daughter would kind of be a woman of her own means when she went into the relationship. But this was about making sure that the daughter had a home, because, I mean, you have to remember, as soon as she becomes the wife, she's got rights. And if mm-hmm. he wants to, if this guy who seduced her wants to throw her away, just as we've read, and we will continue to read in the Torah portion, the wife has rights in these situations. So she's put into a situation of safety. But I really wanted to talk about the sorceress thing, because it's kind of interesting, because when it says you shall not suffer a sorceress to live, we have to ask, why shouldn't we suffer a sorceress to live? Is it because they have all these magical powers? Or is it because...
it makes for a pretty short Harry Potter movie, right? I mean, it doesn't really... that wouldn't sell.
Yeah, that's right.
She turns you into a newt. Yes.
but really, it's about the fact that these people were an affront to the monotheism that Israel had. They were completely pagan. Their ideals, the way they worked, were completely foreign. But what's kind of interesting, that in the Septuagint... the Hebrew word for sorceress is rendered as poisoner and has a much more criminal feel to it.
That so, is interesting.
Yeah, it is. And it turns it from something that's magical, if you like, into something that's a bit more sinister and underhand. But it's worth remembering that.
Whoever lies with an animal shall surely be put to death.
What I find really interesting about this, also from a historical standpoint, the Hittites had a law as well, and their law didn't necessarily say this, but it distinguished against which animals were okay.
No!
Yeah.
No! Why are you saying so? You can... so in,
you're like, oh, well...
So these animals, that's all right, but you don't touch these animals. That's the hippopotamus is all right, but the goldfish you don't do.
Yeah, I can't specify which animals are cool and which ones aren't.
Okay. He who sacrifices to any god except the Lord only, he shall be utterly destroyed. Now, there's some forceful language. We don't see that, you know, before this point. He who sacrifices to any god except for the Lord shall be utterly destroyed. You shall neither mistreat a stranger nor oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Says, you shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. If you do afflict them in any way, and they cry out to me, oh boy, you're in trouble. I will surely hear that cry, and my wrath will become hot, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall be widows, and your children fatherless.
One thing that's kind of interesting about this, too, is that he says, kill you with the sword. It doesn't say some supernatural way, I'm just going to make you drop dead. And we do see that, you know, Israel is often punished for their iniquity by people. So that would be just, you know, look out. If you do this, you might not be successful in your next battle. And you know what? That was God's doing. So,
yeah, really good point, Jason.
Like I mentioned earlier, and I think it's worth reiterating, that this is a group of people who are living under a common set of values and commandments, a common goal, and within the boundaries of a kind of a family unit. So, I mean, we know that there are, you know, millions of people, but they are all descendants, or they've kind of converted into being part of the descendants of Jacob. And so I remember, I could kind of witness a little bit, I suppose, when I was in the Messianic movement, that we would be reading these passages and they'd say, this is absolutely how we have to live now. And so all of these bits earlier on, all of these things about how to live, not just about giving charity and being kind to people, but some of the more kind of rougher parts too, that's how you should treat the people you live with. You know, you should go and if someone's built an altar, you need to tear that altar down. But this isn't how we live today. As Ken says, we don't live as Israel was to live, and we're not in the land. And although I think personally we should try to, especially the positive parts of what we're reading here, looking, I mean, Tovia is always saying, if you want to make the world a better place, go and feed the poor and, you know, clothe the cold and look after the orphans and the widows. And that's absolutely, I think that's the most practical thing anyone can do, is to actually practically do something. Prayer, I think, only gets you so far. But that said, we have to remember that this was a selected group of people in a selected place in a selected time. And although the Torah is eternal, some of these things won't apply to us today. That doesn't mean we can't live up to their values and learn them.
The principle of being.
Right.
Sure.
That's right. We have to try and be the best we can do according to the text, but we can't physically live out some of these things because we, A, aren't in the land where it was supposed to happen, and B, aren't living amongst those people.
So if you lend money to any of my people, if you lend money to any of my people who are poor among you, you shall not be like a money lender to him. You shall not charge him interest. If ever you take your neighbor's garment as a pledge, you shall return it to him before the sun goes down, for it's his only covering him. It is his garment for his skin. What will he sleep in? And it will be that if he cries out to me, I will hear, for I am gracious. You shall not revile God, nor curse a ruler of your people.
It's not that there's a man equated with God. It's that they're both in a position over you, and there's going to be instances where that happen. One I can think of is in 1 Kings, I think it's 21, when it's the story of Naboth's vineyard, when he says, you cursed God and the king. You know, there are instances when men are put above other people and that they should be respected. So that's, I think that's kind of what that's getting into.
Fair enough. Jason?
Isn't it interesting that as we've gone through the text, in my text, whenever it comes to Elohim, it always says God, but there's a little footnote that says judges. And as you've been reading from your text, it's been judges, judges, judges.
Oh,
but when
point.
We get to this verse, it says God. So I'll bet that Christian translations do the same thing, because they don't want to say you shall not revile your judges, because they don't want to imply that the sages of the time are people that you should listen to. I just found that was kind of interesting.
Ah, that's worth throwing into the mix. Fair enough. Okay, so what you're saying is that it could be rendered, you shall not revile your judges nor curse the ruler of your people, which does seem to
it's more
kind
in context.
Of flow.
Yep.
Okay, so there's an alternative. You shall not delay to offer the first fruits of your ripe produce and your juices. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. Likewise, you shall do with your oxen and your sheep. It shall be with its mother 7 days, and on the 8th day you shall give it to me, and you shall be holy men to me. You shall not eat meat torn by beasts in the field. You shall throw it to the dogs. That ends that chapter. Chapter 23. You shall not circulate a false report. Do not put your hand in with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. You shall not follow a crowd to do evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute as to turn aside after many to pervert justice. You shall show no partiality to a poor man in his dispute. Well, that's fair enough. If you meet, now this is interesting, if you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, this is, you know, the animal of your enemy, you shall surely bring it back to him. And if you see a donkey of one who hates you lying under its burden and would refrain from helping it, you shall surely help him with it. I mean, it's kind of like, I guess, if you're driving down the highway, Jason, and you see someone that you one of your enemy or someone you hate, and that car's broken down, you're going to drive straight past there, or you're going to pull over and see if you can offer some assistance. And according to the Torah, it says you will pull over and help.
Absolutely. And what's kind of what's in effect, what they're trying to say here is that any previous action which has happened between you and someone that you've not got on with should be forgotten at this point, and you should do your best to support and love the people that you live with. So supposing the guy that's got the field next to you, he's constantly annoying you. You're pretty sure that when he reaps his field, he's reaping the corner of yours. So you've taken that to the judges, and they've decided whether that was right or wrong, and the judgment might have gone against you. So now you're holding a grudge, and now suddenly you see that his donkey's in your land and its legs caught in the fence. And you know that the more that donkey struggles, the more likely that he's going to break his leg. And then this guy won't be able to carry his grain. And you're going to be able to watch his slow demise. And you can sit back and go, ho, 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 because it's because that's what you want to do, right? But no, the Torah says you absolutely can't do that. We've got judges here and rules and laws in place that if you have a legitimate legal issue, you can go to them. So you should put your best foot forward in all cases. Now, what's very interesting here is that what this says is that you should love your neighbor, right?
Mm.
Now, you may have heard it said that you should love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Where have we heard that before?
Well, that's in the Sermon of the Mount, if I recall correctly. Jesus spoke that in Mark. Is that in Matthew?
Yeah, he says, you've heard it said. Now, he's saying to the Jewish people here that you have heard it said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But my question is, where did they hear that said? That doesn't turn up in the Torah one time. There's no command at any point that says you shall hate your enemy ever in the Torah. It doesn't exist. See, there's kind of two audiences here, right? You've got the Jewish audience that Jesus was supposed to be preaching to, and then you've got the kind of Greco-Roman world that reads the second-hand part of that text when that in 325, that story goes out into the wider population. Now, what they don't know is that when Jesus says, you've heard this, that the people listening hadn't heard that. They assume it's true because it's written. But just to reiterate and to put a nutshell on it, that's it. It doesn't say anywhere in the Torah at all that you should hate your enemy. It's a complete fabrication.
Ken?
Yeah, and I would say it's really not the Torah. And I mean, he might have been saying you've heard it said this and maybe quoting some other source, but it's certainly not in the Torah. So
fair enough. You shall not pervert the judgment of the poor in his dispute. Keep yourself far from a false matter. Do not kill the innocent and righteous, for I will not justify the wicked. And you shall take no bribe, for a bribe blinds the discerning and perverts the words of the righteous. Also, you shall not oppress a stranger. This is the second time this is mentioned. You shall not oppress a stranger, for you know the heart of a stranger, because you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Okay, fair enough. Now, 6 years you shall sow your land and gather its produce, but the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, that the poor of your people may eat it, and what they leave, the beasts of the field may eat. And in like manner, you shall do with your vineyard and your olive grove. 6 days you shall work, and on the seventh day you shall rest, that your ox and your donkey may rest, and the son of your female servant and the stranger, that he may be refreshed. Ken?
Like we said before, this is one instance when it's demonstrating the how the servants or the slaves or however you want to translate Eved comes into be, that they can't work. And that's also interesting that, I don't know if this is the official reason why people do it, but you notice how you're not also to spend money on the Shabbat. And some say, oh, that's taken from Nehemiah because, they were scorned for bringing in merchandise to sell on the Sabbath in the city. But also it's that you're causing somebody else to work. And we don't really understand what it's like to have a slave or a servant or anything like that nowadays, unless you're like, you have a butler Jeeves to drive you around, which I certainly don't. But for any time you're, say, at a restaurant or something like that, that person who is attending to you is, in a sense, not officially, in a sense, I would say your servant for that period of time. Because, they fetch you things, they do things like that. So you couldn't go to a restaurant on the Sabbath, even if somebody was to say, oh, I'll pick up the bill so you won't be breaking the Shabbat. No, you're causing a servant to perform labor on the Sabbath. So I would say that's out too. So that really clears things up.
Well, that's
a
really good point. So whether you pay for it or not, someone is is executing a service that you're taking advantage of. And so you're pointing out that you would rule that out as well.
I would personally, also just kind of to be safe, because there are so many situations when, I work with mainly non-Jewish coworkers, and they love to come to my desk and go, okay, well, what if you're put into this situation or whatever, because they were trying to get me once to attend a party that was on the Sabbath, even though it was within walking distance of my house. And they go, well, what if I gave you a ride, or what if what if we picked up the tab at the bar, or what if we did this to make it okay? If you read this and you put it into that nature, it's really plain and simple. It's not okay, no, because they would, you know, in effect, temporarily be my servant, so I'm not going to do that. I wouldn't tell that person, hey, servant, fetch me another Dr. Pepper, but but I would just kind of hold on to that as, you know, that's the nature of the mitzvah, I would say.
That's a really, no, really good point. And in all that I have said to you, be circumspect and make no mention of the name of other gods, nor let it be heard on your mouth. Now, this is an interesting one because we know that the names of other gods are mentioned throughout the Tanakh. And so what does it mean to not mention the names of the god? Does it mean do not mention the names of the god in respect to worship or to revere such names? Does that sound fair, Ken, to you?
Well, actually, this is interesting to me because it's something I've kind of struggled with, not going around mentioning the names of pagan gods. But there are people that, and I don't even know how I feel about it right now either, how they go, well, I'm not going to say the word Jesus because that is a pagan god of a pagan religion. It's another god, so I won't even utter its name. But they'll, you know, some of those people will go on and say, talk about Nimrod or talk about other kinds of gods in the same sense. But I think it is better to be safe than sorry. But you do have to understand, are you referencing the god of another religion? Are you referencing a historical figure who other people seem to worship as a god? I think that's for one person to decide for themselves.
Okay. All right. So there is. So then we have the three annual feasts. You shall keep a feast to me. Three times you shall keep a feast to me in the year. You shall keep the Feast of Unleavened Bread. You shall eat unleavened bread 7 days as I commanded you at the time appointed in the month of Aviv. For in it you came out of Egypt. None shall appear before me empty. And the Feast of Harvest, the first fruits of your labors, which you have sown in the field, and the Feast of Ingathering at the end of the year, when you have gathered in the fruits of your labors from the field. Three times in the year, all your males shall appear before. Now, I think this says, this might be the first time we see. Can anyone confirm in the Hebrew, is this Adonai and then the Tetragrammaton?
Yep.
I think it is. Yep. Interesting. Okay, that's what it says. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread, nor shall the fat of my sacrifice remain until morning. The first of the first fruits of your land you shall bring into the house of the Lord your God. You shall not boil. This is the first time it's mentioned too. You shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. We're going to see this a number of times. I think maybe it appears three times in the Torah.
Three times, yeah.
And this is one that I'm one of those people that really have to keep an eye out, or at least up until very recently, to make sure that I kept this Torah, because having milking goats, and also, we would keep the males and slaughter them, put them in the freezer. And we did literally have to be careful not to cook a kid in its mother's milk. That was something we had to be particular about.
There is the interpretation of not to mix milk and meat together, but there are a lot of different traditions that state that this was in regards to not dietary, because if we look around here in the context of it, we don't really see a whole lot concerning dietary, what to eat, what not to eat. It had more to do with idol worship and separating. So the commandment to not boil a kid in its mother's milk, that is also now, from archaeological studies, been found to be a Canaanite fertility ritual. So it says don't do this. Don't boil a kid in its mother's milk, because that was seen as something that they do, that something that we do. So that's another interpretation of it. You know, that's just another perspective of it as well. So
we've got to kick it along. We're now in verse 20. Behold, I send an angel. Now, that's, you know, this is what I've got in the English, and I always prefer to use the word messenger. Behold, I send a messenger before you to keep you in the way and to bring you to the place which I have prepared. Beware of him and obey his voice. Do not provoke him, for he will not pardon your transgressions, for my name is in him. But if you indeed obey his voice and do all that I speak, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. For my messenger will go before you and bring you in to the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, and I will cut them off, and you shall not bow down to their gods nor serve them, nor do according to their works, but you shall utterly overthrow them and completely break down their sacred pillars. Jason, a messenger, what do you reckon?
I have to say, we at this show, on this show, are a friend to Christians. I don't want people to think that we don't like Christians. We love Christians. We love all people. We do not love Christianity. And it's not that we're out to destroy Christianity at all. Everyone has a right to believe what they believe.
Mm.
But we do. We also have the right to defend the text and try to portray the original meaning and context of the text as we see it. And let's try to remember that the day before Jesus died, everyone believed the same way as we believed what this text says. But one of the strongest arguments that comes up is that this verse, when I say, well, at no point are we told to believe in the Messiah, you know, because the whole thing is when you need a Messiah, otherwise you can't be forgiven and nothing good will happen and you have to wait for this Messiah. My argument often is we don't need to believe in a Messiah, but then we are told here in this text that God will send an angel ahead of you and that you better listen to him because God's name is in him and that he will not pardon your transgression. So we're not going to say angel because that's not what it says. It says Melech, it says messenger. And we're gonna assume for a moment that that messenger is Moses. And can I reread that with that context?
Please, go on.
Behold, I send a messenger before thee to keep thee by the way and to bring thee into the place which I have prepared. We know that Moses was given to Israel to take Israel on a route and deliver them into a place which God has prepared. So that so far mm-hmm. totally works. Take heed of him and hearken to his voice, Moses's. Be not rebellious against him, Moses, for he will not pardon your transgression. That's normally the strongest part in their repertoire. And why doesn't he pardon their transgression? Because only God can pardon transgression. And it's not that Moses is kind of out to take everyone's soul for being mean. It's literally that's God's job. For my name is in him. And I gave the kind of analogy earlier of a guy who works for the king going to a town to build something for the king, and he finds out that his second in command has been stealing loads of money. It's not up to the guy that was sent to do the job to kill the thief. That's the king's job. But he does, the person that was sent, stands in place of the king. He can give commandments, he can tell people what to do because he's been given a purpose. And Moses had that purpose, but Moses was not in position.
He acts in the authority of God, right?
Absolutely. So God's name was in him, but Moses didn't have the ability to forgive transgression. And it says that you should listen to his voice and do it and do all that I speak, and I will be an enemy. So it says, you know, if you listen to Moses, I will be your friend, I will slay your enemies, and you'll be delivered into the land.
Mm. Well, this just makes perfect sense, right, Ken, because it just reminds me, I've just gone back to Exodus 19, verse 9. It is verse 9, because it says that the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I come to you in a thick cloud, that the people may hear when I speak to you and believe in you, Moses, believe in you forever."
That is correct. As he was going through that, He stole my point. No, that's cool. Because it's, you know, when it's true, it's true. And many people do assume that this is speaking of Moshe. I don't know why angel gets thrown in there so much. I you know, it's clearly Malach and
means messenger.
And Moshe fit the bill. So and he fits all these different bills here too. So we're in complete agreement there.
Nice. Okay, good one. All right, so that's a Torah pill. Verse 25, you shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water and will take sickness away from the midst of you. No one shall suffer miscarriage or be barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days. I will send my fear before you. I will cause confusion among the people to whom you come and will make your enemies turn their backs to you. And I will send hornets before you. Imagine, that'd be, wow.
Do you remember when we had Moses crossing the parting in the sea, and it said,
"Can you imagine having pet hornets that do just No, just I can't get off this. Imagine having your own pet. Imagine having like a hornet's nest on your property, protecting your property, that would just, you know, like, remember like the little flying monkeys in The Wizard of Oz? And she goes, fly, my pretties. Who would do my bidding?
Well, the word there for hornet is, from what my understanding, could be incorrect, is despair. I mean, it means, I think they're kind of lumped in.
Are you taking my hornets away from me?
No, you can have your hornets.
Okay, thank you.
But yeah, they're one and the same.
There is a pre... I'm just going to look it up here. And while I am, I'm going to waffle on a little bit about when the Egyptians chased Moses through the water. And it said that God will cause discomfort on the Egyptians. And it's the same word here. But that was confusion. It says that I will send my terror in verse 27, and we've got reference to that terror or fear in Numbers 22 and Joshua 9:3. But what I'm interested in is this word hornet, because there is reference to this hornet. There we go. Moreover, the Lord God will send the hornet among them. And this is Deuteronomy 7:20. And there's another reference in Joshua 24:12. People can go and look up themselves.
It says, I will not drive them out, you know, all the inhabitants of the land. I won't drive them all out before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and beasts of the field become too numerous for you. Little by little, I will drive them out from before you until you have increased and you inherit the land. And I will set your bounds from the Red Sea to the Sea Philistia, and from the desert of the river, and that would be the Euphrates, right, the river, and I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you shall drive them out from before you. You shall make no covenant with them, nor with their gods. They shall not dwell in your land, lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. Chapter 24, our final chapter of this Torah portion, and here in this opening, we have Israel confirming or affirming, if you like, the covenant. He said to Moses, "Come up to the Lord, you, Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel, and worship from afar. And Moses alone shall come near to the Lord, but they shall not come near, nor shall the people go up with them." So Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the judgments. And all the people answered with one voice and said, "All the words which the Lord has said, we will do." And Moses Moses wrote all the words of the Lord, and he rose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain and 12 pillars, according to the 12 tribes of Israel. Then he sent a young man, young men of the children of Israel, who offered burnt offering and sacrifice, peace offerings of oxen to the Lord. And Moses took half the blood and put it in the basins, and half the blood he sprinkled on the altar. Jason, wait a minute. This reminds me of something. What does this remind me of? Let me keep reading.
Yeah.
It says, let me go back a bit. It says he offered the oxen. Verse 6, Moses took half the blood, put it in the basins, and half the blood he sprinkled on the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant and read in the hearing of the people. And they said, "All that the Lord has said, we will do and will be obedient." And Moses took the blood and he sprinkled it on the people and said, "This is the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you according to all these words." Why is this so familiar, Jason?
Because we did that fantastic, I think it was the first thing we did, the first series of recordings we did was on the Book of Hebrews. We looked at the Hebrew roots of the Book of Hebrews. We did a whole show on this, on the way that this story was portrayed in the book.
We had to look at the Hebrew roots of the Book of Hebrews because the Book of Hebrews is written in Greek.
That's right.
It should have been called Greekos.
It should have been called, yeah. It
should have been called Greekos.
Yeah, the Book of Grecos, author unknown.
The Book of Grecos. It's written in Greek. We thought, that's not right, and we better take it back to its Hebrew roots. And so where is it in the Book of Hebrews where this kind of appears?
Oh, good Lord, was that around 8?
Hebrews chapter 9, verse 19. And this is what the writer of Hebrews does with the passages that we just read in Exodus. It says, "For when Moses had spoken every precept..."
Hang on.
"...to all..."
Do the voice.
"So when Moses had spoken every precept to all the people according to the law. He took the blood of calves and goats with water, scarlet wool and hyssop, and sprinkled both the book itself and the people, saying, this is the blood of the covenant which God has commanded you. Then likewise he sprinkled with blood both the tabernacle and the vessels of the ministry. And according to the law, most all things are purified with blood. And without the shedding of blood, there is no remission of sin. So there, that's why you need Jesus. But there is no such thing in the Torah, is there?
No.
Mixing the blood of calves and goats and water and scarlet wool and hyssop and sprinkling it all over the place. Right.
The author of Hebrews in that passage took every instance that a basin of blood was used and mashed them all together. It's a one-stop shop. Every time that anything has happened, he put them all into one event. And sadly, it's a big load of family show. Speak loud. That's it.
Moving on. What kind of? By the way, what does that sound like to you, Jason? That accent?
It's actually not bad.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, it's really good. I mean, I'd if you rang asking for funds towards the new church roof, I'd hang up. But I think, oh, there's an English guy doing that.
Oh yes, awesome. I'm available for voiceovers. Okay, here we go. This is verse 9. When Moses went up, also Aaron and Nadab and Abihu, 70 elders of Israel, and they saw God, the God of Israel.
Yeah. I think they saw the God of Israel in the way that the God of Israel wanted to be seen. And we get the description of what they saw underneath. So I mean,
in the same way that Moses saw the burning bush, right?
Absolutely, yeah. or any number of prophets see God in different ways. I mean, I think that God projects Himself in a way that the viewer will understand, in a way that makes Him seem magnificent in the context of what these people know.
This is magnificent. Mm. Under His feet, it was paved work of sapphire stone. And it was like the very heavens in its clarity. But on the nobles of the children of Israel, he did not lay his hand. So they saw God, and they ate and drank. They ate and drank in his presence. Then the Lord said to Moses, come to me on the mountain and be there, and I will give you tablets of stone and the law commanding, which I have written, that you may teach them. So Moses arose with his assistant Joshua, and Joshua was there. And Moses went up to the mountain of God, and he said to the elders, wait here until we come back to you. Indeed, Aaron and Hur is there as well with you. If any man has difficulty, let him go to them. Then Moses went up to the mountain, and the cloud covered the mountain. And now the glory of God rested on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called out to Moses in the midst of the cloud, and the sight of the glory of the Lord was like a consuming fire on the top of the mountain in the eyes of the children of Israel. So Moses went into the midst of the cloud and went up into the mountain. And it ends this way. Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. Wow. In that, my goodness. But he's there, he's there collecting the tablets of stone. Parting thoughts, Jason.
Nadab and Abihu, it's kind of interesting that they were part of this party that went up and ate and drank in the presence of God on his mountain. And I wonder whether, because we know they meet in untimely, spoiler alert,
right, really?
They meet in untimely end, and I wonder whether it was that they felt that they could be that familiar because they'd done it already. But you know, something we can think about later on. But no, I've enjoyed that. Thank you very much, Ken. You really...
Thank you, Ken!
Yeah, great.
Thank you, Ken of Tulsa, Oklahoma. Ken Lane, otherwise known as Yefet Ben Ezra of OkieHebrew.com. OkieHebrew.com. O-K-I-E. Hebrew.com. Thank you, my friend. Such short notice joining us on Torah Pills. I hope you join us again very soon.
Oh, I enjoyed it immensely. It was a great wake-up from... you know, just getting a phone call from you and going, oh, we're going to do this and you need to be here now. Go.
And we appreciate you getting on the program at such very, very short notice. Jason of spiritualbabies.net. Dear listeners, check out both websites, both very, very good websites. Thank you, gentlemen. And next week we're going to be in Terumah, Exodus chapter 25, verse 1 to 27, verse 19. Until then, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.